we've seen a charade regarding Epstein for quite some time. And you got to keep in mind that there are four presidents that have covered this up. Bush, too, started the cover-up. Obama continued the cover-up. Biden continued the cover-up. And Trump has continued the cover-up. Where Trump made a mistake, I believe, is that he thought he could crack Pandora's box open and then quickly shut it. And he cracked Pandora's box, and the curse came out. The Epstein curse came out. And Trump has been very successful at burying things, but this couldn't be buried.
Hi, I'm John Kiriakou, and welcome to Deep Focus. Before we get started, I wanted to ask if you would do us a favor. That favor is to subscribe, like, and share this interview with your friends, with your colleagues, with whomever on social media. It helps us a great deal because it hits that algorithm right in the sweet spot, and we're better able, more easily able to spread the word. So thanks for that. Today, we're going to talk about something that has been in the news a lot over the last week, month, the last several years, ever since 2019 when Jeffrey Epstein committed suicide. And that is the so-called Epstein files, the so-called Epstein documents. Do they even really exist? We know that emails do. We know that because Democrats last week in Congress released about 20,000 pages of these documents. There's been a lot of pressure on Donald Trump to release whatever these documents or files happen to be. He promised that he would order such a release during the campaign for president in 2024, but no such release has been forthcoming. Well, now we've got the Attorney General of the United States saying that there is no such thing as an actual Epstein file. So what's the truth here? And if there is a file, who's implicated? And why hasn't the president ordered the release? We're going to talk about all this with someone who probably knows this issue better than anybody else in America, and that is Nick Bryant. Nick is an investigative journalist, an activist, and an officer in Epstein Justice. He's also the author of the book, The Franklin Scandal, a story of power brokers, child abuse, and betrayal. Nick, welcome back to the show. It's good to have you.
Good to be with you, John.
Thank you, sir. So let me ask you the most basic question. Is there such a thing as an Epstein file, or are all of these documents that we've waited for with bated breath just meaningless emails that we may have seen already in the past?
I think the emails are giving us new information, for sure. I mean, they're showing the breadth of Epstein's connections. And the emails between Epstein and Ehud Barak are very telling, because it showed that Epstein was sculpting geopolitical events. I think that at this point, we need more documentation, but the emails give us a glimpse. And I just want to add a caveat before I talk about those emails. The first email that was released by the House, Epstein is emailing Maxwell, and Epstein says, "The dog hasn't barked," and he's alluding to Trump. I think he's thinking that somebody was an informant, but this is from 2011. This was like 4 years after he'd been busted by the police. So he said that the dog hasn't barked or something like that. And then he said, "Trump's been with this victim for hours." And that document is pretty damning, because it's from 2011, when years after Donald Trump said Epstein was persona non grata. But someone put an unredacted version on the internet that says Virginia. Instead of just the redacted victim, it says Virginia. And if that is the case, that's really problematic, because Virginia said she never was molested by Trump. And she also said, and she was also living in Australia at that time. So I've spent the last couple of days sleuthing, trying to find where that email came from. I've got a connection to the Oversight Committee, and I've emailed that person, and that person, I emailed that person three times. I said, just give me a yes or a no on this. And actually other people have too, and they've been mum's the word. And so I did some sleuthing and I was able to trace the origin of that email to someone named MJ Truth Ultra. So MJ Truth Ultra doesn't really strike me as the kind of person that would have access to unredacted documents, but I just wanted to add that caveat before we started talking about the emails.
No, I'm glad you did. I also wanted to ask you to comment on something that the New York Times reported on over the weekend. They went through a lot of these emails, or all of these emails, and what they found, they said, was they used the word sad. I used the word pathetic. It was a lot of movers and shakers from New York society, from Wall Street, the swells who eat at the fancy restaurants or go to the popular clubs. And they're all now accused of Me Too violations, being handsy with the women in the office, for example. And they're actually reaching out to Jeffrey Epstein and asking for advice. How did you get through this? How can I get through it? It was sickening, to tell you the truth. But that was the focus of the New York Times over the weekend. Is that really the story here? Or are we looking for something that's much bigger?
I think there's multiple stories here, actually. Those particular emails, it's very strange that you would go to a registered sex offender and pedophile for advice on sexual harassment. But Epstein was able to emanate this omniscience that people really thought, I believe, that he had was very omniscient. And when you get into the emails between Epstein and Ehud Barak, the former prime minister of Israel and also an accused pedophile, actually a very violent accused pedophile, you get to see just how powerful Jeffrey Epstein is, that he is helping Ehud Barak and the Israeli government sculpt geopolitical events. So with Epstein, these emails are a beginning. The one that I think is the most incriminating and the one that was released first was Epstein saying that he thinks that Trump hasn't barked, but and he's with a victim and he's been there at my place and he's been there for hours. That is a very incriminating email from 2011. And these emails are coming from 2017, which is years after Donald Trump ostensibly banished Jeffrey Epstein from his life. So we're seeing is, according to these emails, Donald Trump has told a number of lies concerning his ongoing relationship with Jeffrey Epstein.
I want to ask you specifically about these revelations relative to Ehud Barak. Ehud Barak was a giant in America because he was an Israeli prime minister that the American government believed it could work with. He supposedly supported ongoing negotiations with the Palestinians, et cetera, et cetera. These emails make him look like a monster. And indeed, he may very well have been a monster. So what is it that's new that we're learning about Ehud Barak and about the Israelis? And the reason I say Israelis is because I'm on record as saying that in my experience as a CIA officer, when I see this kind of evidence, it leads me to believe that Epstein was what we would call an access agent for the Israeli government, trying to get close to senior American officials, American business leaders, in order to glean non-public information and send that information back to the Israeli government. But then it doesn't explain Ehud Barak. Can you enlighten us on that?
The woman that started the allegations against Ehud Barak was Virginia Giuffre, who committed suicide some months ago. And she had a book come out recently called Nobody's Girl, and she refers to Ehud Barak as the prime minister. That's it. But I knew Virginia, and she was terrified of Ehud Barak, terrified, because he was very violent. She was terrified of his violence, and she was also terrified of his connections to the Mossad. And she was a fearless woman for quite some time. And she was also terrified of Les Wexner because of Les Wexner's ties to the mafia. Now, I was able to show that Les Wexner had numerous ties to the mafia in an article I wrote some years ago. So with Virginia Giuffre, I mean, it's a very sad story, but she was ultimately terrified of Ehud Barak. And the way that she described her interactions with Ehud Barak are palpable and horrific. And I don't believe that she was just conjuring her interactions with Ehud Barak out of whole mail, a whole cloth.
What do you think? Who do you think ultimately had responsibility for this Epstein situation? Epstein aside, of course, he has to take responsibility for his actions. But there had to be somebody behind him, supporting him, funding him. It couldn't have all been Les Wexner. And then at the same time, how did he get that sweetheart deal with the government back in 2006? A deal like that would have to have gone to the president for approval. No attorney general, especially not one as weak as Alberto Gonzalez, would have allowed a sweetheart deal like that to go through without the president's approval. So what do you think we're actually looking at here? Was he working for the U.S. government? Was he working for the Israeli government? Was he working on his own with maybe support from one or both governments? What's the conclusion?
I've always said that Epstein was working with Israeli intelligence and also American intelligence. I think it's pretty obvious. And the emails from Ehud Barak to Epstein and vice versa definitely shows he's working for the Israeli government. But then when you look at the sweetheart deal, there's only the U.S. Attorney Alexander Acosta for the Southern District of Florida. He's not going to make a sweetheart deal with Epstein like that. He's not going to cover up a nationwide or international pedophile network. He's not going to go out on a limb like that. He's going to kick it up to Alberto Gonzalez. And then Alberto Gonzalez, you're right, is going to kick it up to the president. So my theory is that he was working for both Israeli intelligence and also American intelligence. You can talk to Ari Ben-Menashe, and his take is different. His take is that Bush was doing a favor for Israeli intelligence. But as a former intelligence agent, do you think that the CIA, the very dark side of the CIA, is going to allow the very dark side of the Mossad to compromise American politicians on American soil without getting a cut of that intelligence?
No. Not in a million years. That doesn't make any kind of sense at all. Not the least reason being that the CIA and the Mossad have traditionally hostile relations because the Israelis won't stop spying on Americans. But no, there's no reason for the CIA to do a favor for Mossad like that. Absolutely not. And even if they wanted to, which they wouldn't, they would have to get the approval of at least the National Security Advisor and probably the president.
In this case, with Epstein's sweetheart deal, it's very obvious that it was Bush was the prime mover for the sweetheart deal. And constitutionally, there's only two people that can tell a U.S. attorney to stand down. One is the attorney general, one is the president. So it went all the way up. And which I believe shows that Epstein was also working for American intelligence, was compromising. And Epstein, I think we have, Epstein has multiple talents. Les Wexner gave him power of attorney over his kingdom in 1991. Just handed him the keys to the kingdom. And Epstein could do whatever he wanted with Les Wexner's billions. And you see these things reported, and this is from Vanity Fair, which I've always thought was a little on the ridiculous side. Vanity Fair reported that the reason why Les Wexner gave Jeffrey Epstein power of attorney over his billions was that Wexner was lonely. You cannot make stuff like that up. And then Leon Black, who was head of Apollo Management and also a pedophile, who I believe was Epstein was providing underage girls to, he gave Epstein $160 million or $170 million, depending on who you talk to. And he said, and multiple media outlets reported, it just wasn't Vanity Fair, multiple media outlets said that he gave Jeffrey Epstein $160 million so Jeffrey Epstein could help him with his taxes. Now, a guy like Jeffrey Epstein, I mean, Leon Black has a battalion of accountants, so he doesn't have to pay one penny more than he should or needs to, which he probably pays less in taxes than you and me. But that's such a ridiculous, disingenuous cover story. I originally thought, when I was digging into Epstein, I've been digging into Epstein since 2012, when I was originally digging into Epstein, I thought that these things were a function of blackmail.
Yes.
But actually, they very well might be a function of blackmail, but I think Epstein was a world-class money launderer. And we've seen that with these lawsuits against JP Morgan and Deutsche Bank. There were a lot of things that Epstein was doing that weren't kosher, but JP Morgan, for example, was letting him get away with it. And so I think that Epstein was a world-class money launderer and also a world-class pedophilic pimp. I guess he was talented. If you're on the side of evil, he would be a good guy to, he'd be at like a first round draft choice.
Well, you know, attorneys and investigators will say that it's still not difficult to launder money if you have access to luxury real estate, fine art, or racehorses. That's where most of the money laundering is taking place right now. And Jeffrey Epstein had access to those worlds. He was a part of those worlds.
Jess Staley from JP Morgan, he was essentially head of the investment side. He actually, Epstein provided him with at least one woman that we know of. I mean, he's on record with that. I think she was an adult. He had sex with her in his brother's apartment building on the east side. He let Jeffrey Epstein get away with so many things. And it's very obvious to me that he was compromised and Jeffrey Epstein was laundering money, substantial amounts of money. And I believe that when you look at these really affluent individuals and their relationship with Jeffrey Epstein, it gets to be quite remarkable. There was according to our media, Bill Gates and Jeffrey Epstein didn't meet till 2011. But there's an article from the Evening Standard in the UK from 2001, I believe, that says that Bill Gates and Jeffrey Epstein were doing business in the 90s. So there's a lot going on here that we need to explore. Those emails are indicative of just the huge panorama of illegalities of Jeffrey Epstein and his connections. But we really need to start investigating. No one has really investigated Epstein.
Well, that was kind of my next question. Epstein's dead, of course. The issue has moved into the realm of the political. So is such an investigation ongoing? Or if it's not, can you see one beginning?
I believe right now we have the discharge petition that was started by Thomas Massie and Ro Khanna.
Yeah.
And that discharge petition needs 218 votes in the House. And then it'll become Bill, if it gets 218 votes in the House, it'll become Bill 165. And then the House would vote on it. And if it received a majority in the House, it would go to Senate Majority Leader John Thune. And John Thune has expressed very negative ideas about what Ro Khanna and Massey are doing. And he could unilaterally kill that legislation.
Yes.
And if it made it past John Thune, then you'd have the senators voting it. You'd need 51 senators. And then if it, so if it makes it past the discharge,
you'd need 60 to break cloture and no, then 51 to pass it.
Yeah. So, and, but then it has to be signed by Donald Trump. And that's not going to happen.
Well, let me interrupt you on that point. And I'm going to brag and say that I have a master's degree in legislative affairs.
Okay.
All of this is unnecessary. This is a question of Donald Trump saying, release the documents. They are executive branch documents. They are housed at the Department of Justice. All the president needs to do is say, release the documents. But he won't say that. And so Congress, in the form of Thomas Massie and Ro Khanna, decided, well, we're going to force him. So then last night, we're recording this on Monday, the 17th of November. Last night, the president came out and said that he encourages all the Republicans to vote yes to release or to discharge the bill from committee. What the, he doesn't need to do any of that. All he has to do is call Pam Bondi and say, Pam, release the documents. Why do you think he hasn't done that? Why is he playing along with this charade of congressional vote after congressional vote after congressional vote when none of it is necessary and all it does is delay the whole prospect of release?
Yes, he could unilaterally release the documents and he could unilaterally kill a bill to release the documents. Donald Trump has done everything in his power to quash an Epstein investigation. He has called the Epstein pedophile network a hoax on a number of occasions. And people in his administration have called it a hoax. And the worst thing you can say to a survivor of sexual abuse is, I don't believe you. And the best thing you can say is, I believe you. So Donald Trump has said to all those Epstein survivors, I don't believe you. And then the shenanigans with Mike Johnson, where he suspended the House early, and then he's been very reluctant to vote in the congresswoman from Arizona. And he even came out and said Donald Trump was an FBI informant spying on Epstein. And that was so insane that he had to walk that back. So we're dealing with crazy people here. Mike Johnson is not, he's not well. I mean, he has got an app on his phone called Covenant Eye, and his son, 17-year-old son, has an app on his phone called Covenant Eye, and they monitor each other's intake of pornography, which I thought was extremely strange. And
yeah, it is.
As you know, a guy like Mike Johnson, who's into macabre pornography or child abuse material, he would be very ripe to be compromised. And he's acting like someone who is compromised.
I have to agree with you, Nick. I'm not understanding the utter lack of leadership on this issue, whether it's on Capitol Hill or at the Justice Department or at the White House or even in the media. You know, time was when there were teams of investigative reporters at the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the LA Times, and a dozen other places where they would be on this like white on rice. And it's like they're not. Whatever leak happens to come from the Justice Department, they run with it. Or Capitol Hill, they run with it. But we're not really learning anything new. Getting back to John Thune for a minute, I think you're exactly right. I think that Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, realized that the other side had the 218 votes. There was nothing he could do to stop it once the discharge petition was called to the floor for a vote. And so he's just going to rely on John Thune to kill it. And then Donald Trump will be able to say, well, I told everybody to vote for release and they didn't. So there's nothing I can do. When in fact, going back to our original point, this whole charade on Capitol Hill is unnecessary. All he needs to do is call the attorney general and say, release the documents.
We've seen a charade regarding Epstein for quite some time. And you got to keep in mind that there are four presidents that have covered this up. Bush, too, started the cover-up. Obama continued the cover-up. Biden continued the cover-up. And Trump has continued the cover-up. Where Trump made a mistake, I believe, is that he thought he could crack Pandora's box open and then quickly shut it. And he cracked Pandora's box and the curse came out. The Epstein curse came out. And Trump has been very successful at burying things, but this couldn't be buried because there were a number of MAGA people and decent people. A lot of MAGA people are decent people, but I'm talking about other decent people. We want to know what happened with Epstein. And he wasn't able to put the curse back. And that's what he's been dealing with ever since, is the curse. And not only do you have the charade going on and with Mike Johnson and the House, but you've got him putting a notorious, vicious child trafficker in Club Fed in Texas.
Yes.
Where she has a dog, where she does yoga. I find that just stunning.
Listen, I have to tell you, when I was sentenced to 30 months in prison for blowing the whistle on the CIA's torture program, my attorneys stood up in court and asked the judge if she would send me to a minimum security work camp, like the one that Ghislaine Maxwell is in right now. The judge asked the prosecution, any objections? No, they said, no objection. Fine, she says, you're sentenced to a minimum security work camp. I got to the prison. We have an odd system here that you literally just drive to the prison and knock on the door and say, I'm here to turn myself in. And so I did. And I went to the camp, the minimum security camp, and they said, go across the street to the actual prison. And they'll process you and they'll bring you back over here. I said, great. So I go across the street. I'm John Kiriakou. I'm here to turn myself in. They take me around to the back of the actual prison. And I said, no, I'm supposed to be at the camp across the street. And the cop laughed at me. And he said, ha, not according to my paperwork, you're not. Well, I was able to call my attorneys 4 or 5 days later. And I said, hey, they put me in the actual prison with the pedophiles and the drug kingpins and the mafia dons. What do I do? And my attorney said, my God, well, we could file a motion, but it'll be 2 years before we get a court date. You're just going to have to tough it out, buddy. You're going to be home in 2 years. And so I was in the actual prison. Well, listen, number one, there are rules. No sex offenders are permitted in minimum security. They are not permitted because they're dangers to society. The minimum security camps don't have any fences. They don't have any bars on the windows. The doors remain unlocked because you're on your honor not to abscond and just run away, which they do all the time anyway. So the fact that she was taken from a prison that was probably chock full of pedophiles and moved to a camp is absolutely unheard of. Now, the reason why pedophiles are normally placed in low security prisons is actually logical. Unless they've killed the children that they've molested, they're all placed in lows because the maximums, they won't last 15 minutes, they'll be killed. The mediums, they'll probably be killed there or at least get a regular good beating. And their escape risks in the minimums. And so you put them in the lows. She's not in the low. She's in the minimum. So yet another sweetheart deal that just defies any kind of logic. And the thing that's just perplexing to me is that neither the president nor anybody around the president or in the Justice Department have even bothered to try to explain to the American people why this dangerous, infamous pedophile is getting special treatment in the Bureau of Prisons. Can you shed some light on this?
I really can't. According to that very strange document that was released by the FBI and the Department of Justice, which no one signed, Epstein and Maxwell molested over 1,000 victims. Okay, so she and there were no, they had no co-conspirators, which we know is obviously false. But just the sheer amount of young girls that she that fell into her web and who she trafficked and molested is so substantial. And I think it's, I mean, my take on this is that there was some kind of clandestine deal made with the Trump administration where she basically cleared Trump of any malfeasance with Epstein, and then she was put in that prison. And then we've heard about a commutation, and I really hope that doesn't happen. But so far, what we've just seen so much malfeasance with the FBI document that said Epstein didn't act alone. And then Massey, who epitomizes like the Republican Party. I mean, he built his own home. I mean, he's a very solid guy.
Yes. He's a very nice guy, too.
Nice guy. And Donald Trump is actually getting his affluent buddies to fund his primary challenger or his challenger in the primaries because of Massey keeps pushing for this Epstein investigation. There's been so many things that this administration has done, but it's happening right before our eyes.
I want to ask you too. Oh, I'm sorry to interrupt, Nick. Go ahead and finish your thought.
A pedophile network is happening, is being covered up in broad daylight right before our eyes.
I want to ask you about the Democrats' role in this cover-up. You mentioned, and I think this is critically important, you mentioned the fact that the Obama administration and the Biden administration did nothing. We're talking about Democrats in the White House for 12 years, and they did literally nothing to bring this case to an end, to try to make things right with the victims. It's easy to say, well, they were protecting Bill Clinton. They were protecting Bill Gates and the big donors. Is it really that simple, or is there something that we're missing here?
I wrote a book called The Franklin Scandal, A Story of Power Brokers, Child Abuse and Betrayal. And what we see with the Epstein scandal, it's almost a carbon copy of the Franklin scandal. And there have been other networks that have been covered up. I think that this is enmeshed into our political system. And I think that when we look at our political system and we look at the people that we have the choice to vote for, I think it's because our political system has become heavily compromised. With blackmail.
So tell us a little bit about the victims. Virginia Giuffre, of course, was the most well-known. She wrote this very powerful book. She committed suicide just before it came out. I've seen interviews with her family members. They're absolutely heartbroken. What about the other victims, the ones who have come forward? What are we hearing from them about these latest developments?
There's a number of them that have come forward, and actually they just released a video where they were really, really extolling, or they were really calling for an investigation into Epstein. with that said, when the government says there are over 1,000 victims, I believe that. Epstein trafficked underage girls for, I believe, 25 years. But Epstein Victims Compensation Fund was set up. And women that had been molested by Epstein could apply for a settlement from the Epstein Victims Compensation Program. And only 225 women came forward and applied for a settlement. And 150 settlements were granted. But I believe 8 or 12 women declined settlements because if you took a settlement from the Epstein Victims Compensation Program, you had to sign a release that you wouldn't litigate against your other perpetrators. And I've been told that the reason why only 225 came forward is they're terrified. And traffickers are very good at getting into the minds of their victims. I'm sure that Epstein has told just about every victim, if you open your mouth, you know the kind of power I have, you're going to get crushed.
Nick, how would this trafficking have taken place? Can you walk us through this? I mean, I can't imagine Jeffrey Epstein at some truck stop somewhere looking for underage girls and then smiling and giving them candy to get into his car. So how are these girls identified and then physically moved to wherever it is these atrocities were committed against them, whether it was on the island or in his townhouse or somewhere else? How did that happen?
Well, first of all, he's protected. And he's been protected for a very long time. He was a teacher at Dalton, and he didn't even have a college degree. And as people know, Dalton is one of the most elite schools in the United States. And then he bounced around in finance and did some unethical things, got fired from Bear Stearns. And then all of a sudden, he emerges as Jeffrey Epstein, international man of mystery, Gatsby-esque billionaire. And with Epstein, these guys create a machine. And I think Maxwell was really integral in creating that machine, where you get young girls and these traffickers. And that's the one thing where the media has really fallen short. Traffickers are vicious people. Whether they live in mansions on the Upper East Side or they live in trailer courts in Missouri, traffickers are vicious, vicious people. And there's been a couple of books that have been written. Sarah Ransom wrote a book about her experiences with Epstein and Maxwell. And they were vicious to her. They were vicious to Virginia. But what happens is you get some people that are very good at calling victims and gleaning victims. And then the victims are sent out scavenging. If the victims bring someone back, then they get $200 or $300. That was the same thing with the Franklin scandal. So at a certain point, you've got this machine where you've got all these victims that are looking for other victims to bring back because they'll get $200 to $300. And then it's almost like perpetual motion at that point. So, and when you've got someone who doesn't have to worry about law enforcement, then the machine is much, much easier to build. But he and Maxwell built a machine.
And what about prosecution? What about next steps? I would have to think that for the most part, the statute of limitations is expired for many of these crimes, or perhaps all of these crimes if Jeffrey Epstein died in 2019. Do you expect anybody to be prosecuted?
There isn't a I don't believe there's a statute of limitation, a federal statute of limitation for child sexual trafficking.
Okay.
So they can be, definitely, I believe that they can be prosecuted. And we know who a number of them are. Sarah Kellen, she helped run the machine. Leslie Groff, she helped run the machine. Nadia Marcinkova, she helped run the machine. We know who a number of these women are. I mean, there was so the pilots. I mean, there's so many people that could be subpoenaed and actually indicted. And if you, these women that were part of the machine or that kept the machine going, you could easily indict them on multiple counts of child trafficking. And they would roll over on the perps. I mean, if our Department of Justice wasn't run by, I don't really know how you describe Bondi and Patel. I mean, clowns, really. I mean, if our justice system wasn't run by clowns, and we really wanted to get to the bottom of this, it would be a simple RICO case where it's an ongoing criminal organization, and you start indicting the little fish, and then they start turning on the big fish. It would be a pretty easy case. And that's what needs to happen. I started an organization called Epstein Justice. And what we want is an independent congressional investigation. And I think that this can be feasible. We need a majority in the House and a majority in the Senate. We can bypass John Thune. We can bypass Donald Trump. And independent congressional investigations can be very, very effective because a lot of the time they incorporate investigators, citizen investigators. It's just not comprised of politicians, because if this issue went to a subcommittee, it would definitely wither up and die. Subcommittees are very good at.
And that was the whole idea. That was the whole idea of Mike Johnson. Send it to a subcommittee. Let it just die there. Everybody's going to forget about it. He didn't expect a Democrat and a Republican to come together and file a discharge petition. Discharge petitions are exceedingly rare. I mean, people try them all the time, but the success of a discharge petition is very, very slim. There was one, for example, in 1986. It had to do with tax reform, right? And withholding tax specifically. They're almost never successful. This one's going to be successful, to the point where people are going to write books about it. And so I think that on Capitol Hill, they're going to need to get their act together to make sure that they get on the right side of this issue. Because if they're on the wrong side, that's what history is going to remember. It'll be their legacy.
Well, I see Trump hemorrhaging MAGA. There's a lot of MAGA people that have left the building because they see that this is a cover-up. I've met a number of them online, and they see that this is a cover-up. And it's not a cover-up of, like, financial crimes. It's not a cover-up of political problems, political malfeasance. This is a cover-up of child sexual trafficking. And I don't believe, when Trump said he was going to release the Epstein files, I released, as you probably know, I released the flight logs and the Black Book in 2015. And I released more incriminating information about Epstein in 2015 than Bondi did in 2025. And with the Black Book, I told the people at Gawker, they were the only ones that was, I tried to sell it for 3 years, and then they were the only ones that were willing to do this. I said, we've got to redact the numbers of the adults. And then under massage, that was kind of a euphemism for victim. Because I when I dialed those numbers, I talked to various victims. So I said, with the victims, we've got to redact their last name and then their number. And then I saw the Black Book that I put up, and everything was redacted. Everything.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
In the end, Nick, do you think that anybody will be punished for this?
Well, I've worked very hard towards this end, and I'm hoping that we can move the needle with Epstein justice. I've known about Epstein since 2012. And I took a beating with the Franklin scandal. No one wanted to believe what I reported with the Franklin scandal. And it's kind of funny. Some of my friends thought I'd lost my mind when I started pursuing the Franklin scandal, which I spent 7 years investigating. And I was walking through the village a while back, and a friend of a friend, who obviously knew what I'd done, he was screaming at me, "You were right! You were right!" And what? So this issue, I've been watching this issue since 2002, 2003. I know of other networks that have been covered up. So the fact that one of these networks have made it this big as far as being ubiquitous with the media is, that is like a dream come true to me. I mean, I never when we released the Black Book and the flight logs, I thought this will do something, and it really did nothing. But now, it's taken on a life of its own, and I think when you've got a disease, you've got to have awareness, acceptance, and then action. And I think so. We got awareness, and I think we're really moving towards acceptance, and then action, because child molesters, whether they're rich or poor, they need to be put in prison. Yeah. And we know who they are. That's the thing. We know who these people are.
Yeah, society needs to be protected from them. There's no question about it.
And you just can't let child molesters walk. I mean, according to the Centers for Disease Control, 25% of underage girls have been molested and 5% of underage boys. People in the field think it's slightly conservative for underage girls and very conservative for underage boys. There's been a study that's found that 16%. I don't believe it's that high. But if you just go with the numbers provided by the CDC, 50 million Americans have been molested as underage victims. 50 million. So that is a pandemic in our society. And if we say, no, we're not going to, if our government says we're going to cover up a proven trafficking case, think what that's going to do to these millions of victims who want justice, who want hope, who want a voice. If we allow the government to cover up Epstein in broad daylight, like it's trying to right now, we're going to say to these people that have been molested as minors, you have no hope, you have no voice. And that we cannot do.
That's right. Well, Nick, thank you very much for joining us and for enlightening us on this important and quickly changing issue. Good to have you back.
Good to be with you. And I've been really digging into Jeffrey Epstein's geopolitical sculpting with Ehud Barak. And I've come across some amazing stuff. So at some point, we should talk about that.
That I would look forward to very much. Yeah, okay. Thank you. Well, Nick Bryant is an investigative journalist. He's an activist. He's the co-founder of Epstein Justice and author of the book, The Franklin Scandal, A Story of Power Brokers, Child Abuse, and Betrayal. I'm John Kiriakou. Please like, subscribe, share, and join us next time. We'll see you then.